And now we have three speakers from our fellowship, Peg Wary, Paul Stover, and Kathy Cooper, who are going to talk about UUs who are important to them.
When Sandra asked me a few weeks ago to be part of this panel, I had trouble choosing who I would talk about. And I knew I'd been traveling for a couple of weeks right before this, so I remembered a couple of reference works that would help me choose. I picked up Who's Who of UUs at General Assembly in Salt Lake around 2000. I don't remember exactly which year. It's a little out of date, or it needs updating. And my brother-in-law, a minister's spouse, told me about Who's Who in Hell around 2010. And I'll try to leave these out for you to look at. Who's Who in Hell is a handbook and international directory for humanists, freethinkers, naturalists, rationalists, and non-theists. And there is a surprise on every page. So now I had so many choices, I decided to take a book of lists approach. I'm not going to talk about just one person. I'm going to name a lot of people and actually let you chime in on some things, and I hope to cover a lot of ground quickly. But I want to start with a list that I discovered when I stopped in Bend, Oregon in 2015 and attended service in their palatial new building. $5 million buys a lot of church. All of their rooms were, and spaces were named for UUs. For example, Kathy's choice today, Pete Seeger. His name is on the gathering space outside the sanctuary. And there are some delightful surprises. The Beatrix Potter Nursery. An RE classroom named for Buckminster Fuller. Even the Fanny Farmer Kitchen. Who knew? And I had taken this out for time, but they have so much space, they have a green room behind the sanctuary, and it's the Bela Bartok green room. There's Sophia Foss and Olympia Brown, everything's named for UU. But to go back to the reference books, let's start at the top. According to the Who's Who of UUs, Unitarians can claim 6 presidents of the United States. About a year ago, Jack Fisher and I can't remember who else, I'm really sorry.
Michael Lang.
I thought you were saying, anyway. Michael Lang and Jack Fisher talked about some of them. So who are they? Anyone? Bueller? Anyone? Who?
Two Adams.
Jefferson, although he never really joined a Unitarian church, he called himself Unitarian. Washington. No, the next three are later in history and somewhat more obscure. Adlai Stevenson didn't get elected. Yeah. Sandra told us about him a few years ago. Okay, here they are, the stars in the firmament. Millard Fillmore, who served from 1850 to 1853 after Zachary Taylor died. Chester A. Arthur, who was president from 1881 to 1885 after the assassination of James A. Garfield. So they weren't exactly elected president, but they seem to have both done better than expected when they actually took office. And then there's William Howard Taft, who was elected in his own right and was president from 1909 to 1913, and he was also Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1920s. Now, the Who's Who UU book includes several lists from which I compiled my own arts and entertainment division. Mary Oliver, of course, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a whole bunch of those three named writers from the 19th century, Carl Sandburg, Frank Lloyd Wright, painters N.C. and Andrew Wyeth. For Hollywood glitz, and to get into our own time, we can claim Patty Duke, Cher. You have to know her last name to be able to look her up. It's Sarkissian or something like that. Starts with S. Paul Newman and Rod Serling. There's no shortage of scientists and engineers either, though maybe their names aren't so well known. Charles Darwin, of course, Linus Pauling, won 2 Nobel Prizes for... Anybody remember what his name? Chemistry? Peace. The Peace Prize. Charles P. Steinmetz, who invented or discovered, not any electrical engineers here?
alternating current. And Rachel, the two most famous nurses ever.
Clara Barton.
And Florence Nightingale. Okay. So let's move on to areas where our values were powerful in compelling social change. The who's who of you use also reads like a who's who of the American woman suffrage movement. Susan B. Anthony, Carrie Chapman Catt, Julia Ward Howe, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucy Stone. But here we come to a problem. The women's rights movement emerged out of abolition activism. Most of these women had been active in the abolition movement. But when it came time to argue about the 14th and 15th Amendments and giving the vote to black people, I'm sorry to say that Anthony Catt and Stanton all argued against it, saying that we shouldn't give the right to vote to black men while white women did not have it. And the rhetoric did turn a little ugly. It was not one of feminism's finest hours. The civil rights struggles of the 1960s claimed two UU martyrs. They were
the preacher who marched Selma.
Yep, James Reeb, and I heard the other one, Viola Liuzzo. Reeb was with two other UU ministers leaving an integrated restaurant in Selma where they had dined. They were attacked and beaten by four white men. Reeb died 2 days later. Viola Liuzzo, a UU housewife and mother of five, was driving activists from Selma to the Montgomery Airport, and on the way back to Selma, she was shot in the head by someone in a car full of white men. She died instantly. In the 50 years since then, I have always remembered Viola Liuzzo's name. Now, it's not Mary Smith, which helps. I have never remembered if I even knew James Reeb's name. I guess housewife from Detroit was a category my teenage mind had room for, and Unitarian minister was not. What's interesting to me now is that Liuzzo is not mentioned in either of these two reference books. And I think that's a really interesting question. But I want to end up by exploring the very fact that we do this. We keep track of and eagerly claim our famous UUs. My sister doesn't point out famous Methodists. So why is this such a popular parlor game among UUs? Well, it's fun, of course. And we're generally a curious and highly educated lot. The editor of Who's Who in the UUs observes that while our faith has a relatively small membership, our total contribution to human culture has been incredibly great. And lists like this are also helpful in explaining UUism to newcomers. We don't have a creed, but we have exemplars. And I'm not even sure we're comfortable with the concept of a saint, but we could think of some of these people as our saints. And I think, too, that our pride in our tradition and the assertiveness of this big, bright red book, Who's Who in Hell, are ways to push back against the idea that the United States is an explicitly Christian nation. The description of today's service said the service will contribute to our understanding of our fourth principle, a free and responsible search for meaning. But I think all of these people exemplify all of our principles, and I loved that first hymn. And I wanted to say one more thing. When I was writing this, I kept thinking about Bill Weifenbach being sitting here, and it's one of the times I missed him. Thank you.
Can I borrow this book?
I think the Bend congregation needs a playground named after P.T. Barnum. I think I've learned a lot about this guy. P.T. Barnum. So I've only been a Unitarian Universalist for a few years. And I was raised in a never, ever miss Sunday Mass except when you go on Saturday night, Catholic family. So the who's who for much of my spiritual life were the subjects from the Old and the New Testaments of the Bible, not to mention a pope or two, which kind of explains why I am utterly intrigued by the who's who of UU lists. And I'm a big fan of history, as many of you might know. the legacy of our many history makers have, and what the legacy of what many of our history makers have left us. When I was told I could pick one UU to talk about, I was truly a kid in a candy store, only with a 5-minute time limit to get in and get out. I love it. So, as a former certified bell-ringing altar boy, the UU I have chosen to present this morning is Phineas Taylor, better known as P.T. Barnum, the most influential showman of the 19th century, who coincidentally happens to be the current cover story on one of my favorite magazines, American History. So, and I love the nose on it too. Prior to researching P.T. Barnum, I was with the incorrect understanding that his legacy was only that of a man from New York City with a penchant for showmanship based on deception and self-promotion. Barnum wrote a book titled The Art of Money Getting, is recognized as the creator of the modern three-ring circus, and is often attributed to having said, "There's a sucker born every minute." Oh my gosh, he had the qualifications to run for the President of the United States. I'm glad to have researched further into this man's life. There is so much more to P.T. Barnum than the big top. Born in Connecticut in 1810, an early influence was his Universalist grandfather, who acquainted P.T. with the belief of the universal salvation of humanity. He even served as a clerk with the Universalist Church in Danbury, Connecticut. When he was in his early 20s, he edited his own newspaper, which he had started partly to combat what he perceived to be sectarian attempts to bring about a union of church and state. And he even spent time in jail. Then he took a little diversion. When he was 25, he moved to New York City. He got his start in show business when he exhibited Joyce, a woman who claimed to be the 161-year-old former slave and childhood nurse to George Washington. Quote, "The first person to put clothes on the infant who was destined to lead our fathers to glory, to victory, to freedom," claimed Barnum. He charged a quarter to see her, which is about $6.50 in today's dollars. I'd have paid $10 to see her. I'd have paid $20 to talk to her. Barnum made today's equivalent of about $40,000 per week with this attraction. He later charged 50 cents admission to Joyce's autopsy after she died. When the autopsy showed that Joyce was closer to probably 80 years old, Barnum claimed that they autopsied the wrong woman. And that Joyce was still alive. He just wouldn't tell him where. So where does a guy like P.T. Barnum pulling a stunt like that leave us a legacy associated with our fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning? Later in life, Barnum acknowledged that while even he originally thought Joyce's story was true and that he made a lot of money, the hoax was an embarrassment and he moved on from the shameless start. The shameless start was actually the title of the article. So, this evolved into a small touring circus until 1842, when he opened the American Museum back in New York City. Setting down some roots, he got involved with the Universalist congregation there. He was on the Sunday School Committee. Would not that have been an interesting committee to sit on? And he was a generous contributor toward the Fourth Universalist Society building that still stands in New York City today. But he was still the showman until his death in 1891. Barnum continued with his exhibits, including midgets, the most famous of whom was the General Tom Thumb, who was 3'3". He had Siamese twins, he had circus acrobats. In 1870, he started the Great Traveling World's Fair, which evolved into the Barnum and Bailey Circus, the greatest show on earth, and its great star, Jumbo the Elephant. Historians agree that in his business ethics and after the Joyce hoax, Barnum was more honest than most people who had been in the entertainment and public relations field. I know that. having a little exposure to that myself. He offered his customers good value, which is why they returned again and again to his various productions, and he considered himself a public benefactor. Most Americans, he thought, worked too much and, as a consequence, did not know how to spend their leisure time. Probably still some truth to that today. Quote, "Americans' inclination to intemperance and kindred vices," he wrote, "has repeatedly and most conclusively been shown to be a natural result of the lamentable deficiency among us of innocent and rational amusements." In the magazine article, it was evident that P.T. Barnum detested preachers and their moral code governing the conduct of human affairs, but in recognition of the power of the pulpit, Barnum's advance promotions for his events were frequently done with the intent to get the local ministers on board, to put some spin on why it was okay for their flock to see his exhibits. And it worked. And this is no doubt a big contribution to what became his philanthropic behavior. He was a generous supporter of causes endorsed by the National Universalist Movement. He gave its newly founded Institute of Higher Education, Tufts College, near Boston, $50,000. And these figures that I throw out are all from 150 years ago, so quite a bit more today, to establish a museum of natural history. And then he later gave Tufts another $100,000 to build some wings to the museum. He sent the museum mounted skins, skeletons, other animal remains, and he contributed Jumbo's hide there. And Jumbo, for those of you that are from that area, Jumbo is Tufts College mascot and remains Tufts College's school mascot. He did not neglect other Universalist educational projects either, such as St. Lawrence University and Lombard College. Barnum had among his friends many Universalists and Unitarian ministers and laypersons, and during the last 10 years of his life, he was a church trustee and was often in the pulpit himself. Per the UU website, about 12 months before he died, Barnum wrote out his religious beliefs entitled Why I Am a Universalist, and it was published in 1890 as a pamphlet, and within a year 60,000 copies had been circulated and already translated into other languages. While he never actually said there's a sucker born every minute, P.T. Barnum will forever be known as the showman with a skill for fleecing the multitudes, even though he saw it as helping people momentarily escape from their day-to-day living. But privately, he ensured that thousands of others could continue with a free and responsible search for truth and meaning as Universalists. And that's the P.T. Barnum that I know now.
Well, I don't know if you guys know this, but my first husband was actually a clown in the circus. He went to Clown College. We went to the 25th anniversary of Clown College with Dick Van Dyke. So, anyway. I am going to, however, speak about Pete Seeger. After I agreed to speak here today, I got online and viewed a list of prominent UUs. I was immediately struck and surprised by the number of influential people on that list. Many of them have had a profound impact on me at different times in my life. Paul Newman, for example. People of a certain age, who didn't fall in love with Butch Cassidy? And there he was, a UU outlaw with dazzling blue eyes. A few notables on that list jumped out at me. Morris Dees, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, whose autobiography I just finished reading. And Charles Dickens, whose tales and unforgettable characters I have adored since childhood. And Pete Seeger, whose music has been a part of my life, all of my life. As Peg already shared with us, there have been many noteworthy UUs throughout its existence. How to decide? I whittled down my list to two, Morris Dees and Pete Seeger. In considering where we are in history, and with potentially volatile political upheaval just around the corner, metaphorically speaking, of course, I settled on Pete. Morris is still waging the good fight against white supremacy and those who discriminate and commit crimes of hate. I salute him and am grateful for his work. In light of this incredibly contentious campaign cycle, and with all of the mean-spiritedness, untruths, condescension, discriminating and incriminating speech it harnessed, and with its shocking outcome, I have found myself despairing. And those of you that hang out with me know that I just sometimes break down in tears, and I don't know what to do about it. I find it almost impossible to digest the knowledge that so many fellow Americans deem it acceptable to embrace and openly express disdain for those they view as other. So when Pete Seeger's name appeared toward the bottom of the list of UU notables, I knew that I needed to plug him into my music stream. Sit down and listen. And because of the powerful influence he has had on so many of us, and because I think we need to hear his voice raised now more than ever, I'm going to share a bit of his story with you. Peter Seeger was born in Paterson, New York, on May 3, 1919, 4 days after my dad, who was born in Pittsburgh on April 30th of that same year. Though Dad never became a UU, he managed to raise three of them. And to date, four out of five married grandchildren were married by ordained UU ministers. Pete rose to prominence on the music scene of the 40s as a member of the Weavers, a popular American folk group. Their hit Goodnight Irene topped the charts for 13 weeks in 1950. After being blacklisted during the McCarthy era, he again emerged on the scene with songs of protest in support of civil rights, the environment, and the cessation of war. His music was widely shared by several artists and groups during the turbulent 60s. And when I was an elementary student and a middle school student, my older siblings had Pete Seeger, the Kingston Trio, and Peter, Paul, and Mary records on all the time. They were who we listened to. And his were the songs we often sang around the campfire when on our yearly family camping trips. If I Had a Hammer, co-written with Lee Hayes, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and Mary, Don't You Weep, an old-time spiritual whose lyrics Pete adapted. Pete gave a loud and resounding, and yes, lyrical voice to the many social, environmental, and political struggles of our existence. He wrote new songs, he reinterpreted traditional folk songs, he marched, he demonstrated, he entered classrooms to teach and share, and he inspired millions. He wrote songs with titles like Bring 'Em Home, Take It from Dr. King, My Name is Lisa Cavledge, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and The Emperor is Naked Today-o. This last song seems to have particular relevance today. At least, it resonates profoundly for me, and I would like to share it with you now. But I have to turn on my iPad, so give me just a moment. And we are lucky because we'll get to hear Pete sing it. It's been covered by other people, but let's see. So, on with the speech. Pete Seeger died on January 27th, 2014. My dad died on September 15th, again, of that same year. Both men profoundly influenced me through their expressions of justice and what was right. Both of them encouraged me to speak out, to be someone guided by strong principles and goodness. Though my dad's voice has been silenced, except for the voice that rings in the souls of those who knew and loved him, Pete sings on in his many recordings and in the many covers of his work. This is a time of great confusion and fear, and distrust of one another and the system. Now, perhaps more than ever, we need to hear Pete Seeger's voice guiding and inspiring us to action and to perseverance. So, I suggest that when you go home, you dust off your old record jackets and blast Pete's ballads loud and clear. For those of you no longer in possession of your old 33s, or don't even know what a 33 is, go to Spotify, Pandora, or wherever else you listen to music and download Pete's tunes. Let's hope that his voice will reignite a fire in those of us who were inspired in the 60s and 70s, and that he will gain a whole new generation of soldiers for the good fight. May the bells of peace and justice ring.